This podcast may contain language that's not appropriate for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Today we're doing Love Actually again, a.k.a. Love Actually. So if you haven't seen it and you don't want us to ruin it for you, you might want to pass on this one, and we will see you next time.
Are you ready
for one dry kiss?
This is...
Keep it going. Keep it going, Corinne.
Welcome to One Dry Kiss, our cussy irreverent love letter to rom-coms. We're in the month of August when school is starting and summer heat is getting you down. We give you a nice, icy, snowy dash of Christmas in August. And today we're doing part two of Love Actually, a.k.a. Love Actually-er. I am here.
Can't even call it a recap at this point. We're like elongating it. We are extending the Christmas cheer in this movie over two whole episodes.
Two.
Count them, two.
Oh, two glorious whole episodes. I am here with my lovely co-host who puts the jingle in my jangle and who also is the one who, be still her beating heart, has been wanting to do Love Actually and Love Actually-er, Miss Tamara Cosio.
Please don't say be still my beating heart, because you know I have high blood pressure and it's bothering me.
I mean, calm down. It's fine. Breathe.
Oh, God. Not helping. Feeling a little bit of pressure rising. It's going up. It's going up, people. And I am here with my chinga 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 childhood best friend who loves Christmas, Corinne Edding.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So let's talk about Love Actually. How do you think it's going so far, Corinne?
Right now there's a lot of potential, and I had something very important to bring up.
Oh God.
Banoffee pie.
I'm sorry, what?
When Juliet goes to creepy best friend Mark's place and is like,
yes,
I brought you banoffee pie, and he's like, I'm not really into banoffee pie, and she's like, yeah, most people aren't. I'm glad you said no. I was hoping you would. And I was like, what in the horrible Epicurean British history is banoffee pie? I looked it up.
What is it?
Because I was worried that it was one of those fake desserts that seemed like they would be delicious, like Christmas pudding, and is not. But banoffee pie, actually, is something I wouldn't mind tasting. It is a British dessert pie made from bananas, whipped cream, and a thick caramel sauce combined either on a buttery biscuit base or one made from crumbled biscuits and butter. Ta-da! So, seems pretty tasty to me.
Banoffee pie? Why wouldn't he be into banoffee pie? He is a monster. Mark is a monster.
I know. That should have been like the clue right there that something was wrong.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm not into banoffee pie. Reek, 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 reek. Get a psycho close-up on his eyes. Oh. So I have a thought. What if we had an alternate ending for all the love stories in Love Actually?
Ooh.
And nobody wound up with anybody.
Oh, nobody wound up with anybody?
Nobody wound up with anybody. I had the thought today when I was doing my synopsis. I was like, all right, well, they don't end up together. They don't end up together. They get divorced. He goes to jail.
I can think of a couple of people who you'd be referring to with that
yes.
statement.
Yes, I bet you could. Yeah, yeah. He gets kneed in the groin. Yeah. No, that could work. That could also like be kind of funny. Very humorous. Still Christmassy. Still within good cheer. So my mind ran amok. But I don't want to give out any spoilers, because if I tell how people aren't going to get together, then people will figure out how they are going to get together, like a spoiler or whatnot.
Right. And when we reach the end, I also have a couple of theories about a couple of things.
Yes.
So...
And I fully anticipate that people don't look to us as the experts on Love Actually. I'm not going to watch the movie. I'm just going to listen to Corinne and Tam regale me with it via the podcast. And then I feel like I don't have to watch it at all.
See, that's how I feel about like TCO and stuff like that. I just listen to them. I'm like, I'll take you at your word for the documentaries that you cover. Great.
Yes. Although there are some instances, one that I'm listening to right now, not TCO, but I am back into that aged well.
Uh-huh.
And they're going over Superman, the movie.
Oh.
And they fucking make it sound like it's the one superhero movie that's so soothing. And I'm like, I want to see a soothing superhero movie. What the hell? Like, I can't even like put that. I know I've seen Superman a couple of times, but the way they're talking about it, it's like, okay, I got to watch this again.
And with that aged well, like when they covered Urban Cowboy, I was like, I can totally see what is happening in my mind. It's a beautifully well done movie, and I am not watching that. I do not need that kind of heartache in my life.
Same.
Thank you.
All the way.
I appreciated them covering it so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Twinsies, because I've never seen Urban Cowboy. Cowboy, nor do I ever want to after I heard their episode on it. I was like, oh, this sounds, oh my God, no.
Yes.
No. Are you fucking kidding me?
Let's have some despair. Layer a bit more despair on top of it. And then on top of that, maybe we should add some despair.
And then you're going to get tragedy in a big rock form, and you're going to squish down the despair with the tragedy. So it's one hard clump of shit. The end.
Oh, but you forgot, like, the sprinkling of, like...
No. No, we don't need more. No.
Sorrow, sadness. Let's just leave
it at that. I can't, my heart... No, my heart can't take it. Heart can't take it. Remember, high blood pressure.
So I am very grateful that they have gone over some movies that I'm just like, wow, that movie is really amazing. Super not going to see it. Thank you for covering it.
Yes. And as I said before, we are not experts on anything. So please don't take everything that we say at our word. Speaking of which, Corinne, I was looking up the movie that you referred to on Love Actually Part 1, and you're...
I can't remember what movie that was that I referred to.
It was the one on your wall that you were like, I love...
Oh, DOA! Yes!
DOA! And it's, you said it was Dead on Arrival, but when I looked it up, it said it was Dead or Alive.
Oh, Dead or Alive, sorry. There's a D-O and an A in there. Dead or Alive. Thank you. I appreciate you correcting
correction
that.
Corner! We had a correction corner!
Yes!
I'm surprised it hasn't happened before, because I know I say a lot of bullshit that is not true at all, so.
Well, you actually, we should have done a correction corner.
We should have. I
do a belated correction corner on.
From 7 episodes back.
The Dynasty reference I made in Hope Floats. You left me a note.
I did. Dynasty reference in Hope Floats.
Dallas. The Dallas reference
in
Hope Floats. Do you want me to read what you said to me?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, if you have it.
Quoth Tamara, you say for the Dallas-themed wedding that Bobby Clare's sister made a perfect Linda Evangelista, but I think you might have meant Linda Evans. Linda Evangelista is a supermodel, but Linda Evans was in Dynasty, not Dallas. So I'm not sure if that's what you meant either. And I was like, true.
Oh my God, I went down like a huge rabbit hole, because I'm like, Linda Evangelista, Linda Evans searched Dallas, nothing came up. It was like a bunch of obscure weird things, and I'm like, huh, let me just look up Linda Evans, best known for Dynasty. Oh, there it is. There it is, yep. They did come out at the same time, though, in fairness.
And they were, like, similarly adult evening soap opera.
Right, yeah.
Kind of things. So,
Why do they both have to start with D? That's your fault there.
I know.
That's on you.
I know. Jeez. Mm. Anywho, yes. I got a couple of things all mixed up, mandala affected together. But I still liked the comment, so I was like, I'm keeping it in, flaws and all.
I love my flaws. I don't care.
I definitely was thinking of Dynasty people. Dynasty ladies, not Dallas ladies. Although I guess I could have picked Victoria Principal. I don't have a good concept of anyone in Dallas other than J.R.
Ewing. That's what happens when you don't watch adult 80s late night smut, Corinne. Oh, primetime smut. It was primetime.
My parents would not allow me to watch that. So, yeah. Why not? I was only, oh my God, it went into through 91. Can you believe Dallas lasted that long? From 1978 to 1991.
Shut up. Like 13 years?
356 episodes.
Oh God, nope. Would it be like the old standard, you know, daytime soap operas where, oh my God, is she gonna die? She's in the hospital on a ventilator. 7 weeks later, she's still on the ventilator. Like, I didn't.
She dies, but like, look whose identical twin came into town that we never knew she had.
Right. But it takes them like umpteen weeks to get to the climax. And even then, it's like, let's draw this out a little bit more.
Yeah.
We can squeeze some more juice out of it.
Apparently, there was 14 seasons of Dallas.
Yeah, I don't think I missed anything.
Nah. So we have correction cornered all over the place.
I'm sure we have many more mistakes, dear listeners. We are not trying to pretend like we don't. Just give us a pass on those other ones that we haven't mentioned. Thanks a lot.
So Tamara, did you do a synopsis for us to like help like catch us up to where we are?
No, I just stole a bit from Corinne to say a lot more things happen to a lot of people during the Christmas season, because we only have like 72 storylines going on at the same time. Okay, maybe it's not 72, but let's see. There's just John and Judy, the porn simulators who are falling in love while pantomiming dirty deeds. There is the prime minister who's fighting his loins tooth and nail to not sexually harass his employee, Natalie. Sarah, who can't seem to get off the phone long enough to pursue her crush, Carl, who incidentally Corinne was lusting after the last episode. If Corinne were Sarah, I'm sure there'd be a Sarah-shaped hole in the wall from her rushing to get some. Billy Mack, who's not in any sort of relationship except for the one he has with this beleaguered manager, Joe. Harry, a middle-aged man who's married to Karen, but is slowly but surely getting seduced by his employee, Mia. Jamie, who meets the love of his life, Aurelia in France, but he only speaks English and she only speaks Portuguese. Colin Frissell, who's fucked off to the United States because British girls are just too stuck up for him. Daniel, who's recently lost his wife to cancer while simultaneously dealing with his stepson Sam's major crush on Joanna, who should be the songbird of our generation. And finally, the cringy throuple that is Juliet, Peter, and Mark. Mark and Peter are best friends, and they're both in love with Juliet. Awkward. So all together, and I'm counting the infidelities too, that's like 12 love stories. Whew, no wonder why this shit is in two parts.
That was amazing.
An amazing recap. And so let's meet back with all our infatuated basket cases to find out if love actually is all around us. Corinne, back to you.
Well, yes, Tamara, I am ready to get started on the middle of this journey.
Yeah, the middle, and we're bringing it home right now. Gonna explore all of those different faucets of love that Corinne was exploring. Faucets, because love is all around. It flows like water.
Oh, you're right. How could I be so wrong? Oh,
it's okay.
I'm gonna go wash my hands. So, and now we're at the long-awaited office party of the London office of Harry, who's married to Karen. They have the children who are in the nativity play, but more remarkably, the daughter who is the first lobster. And
Harry played by Alan Rickman.
Yes, Harry played by Alan Rickman. Mia, who is all like Sharon Stoning Harry and like sitting in her desk chair and like opening her legs a little wider. Yes.
Gosh, Dolly G, what happened to her? What happened to Mia that she just comes out puss first like that? That's bold.
Yeah. She makes me feel feelings that aren't as, you know, supportive of women as I would like.
And their sexuality. Like, you want to be...
And their sexuality, yeah. Exactly.
Comfortable in your sexuality, but Mia makes me want to say, reel it in a little bit. Just a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm reeling the fish in. I'm reeling the fish back in.
I just want to have a sit down with Mia and just be like, tea, biscuits, let's have a talk. What's going on here? What are your motivations? What's the dealio?
You know, there's something called BetterHelp. We're not sponsored by them, but apparently it might be beneficial for you to check something out like that, Mia.
Yes, absolutely. And the London office of Sarah, who is always on the phone with a mystery person and has the crush on Carl.
Hot Carl.
Hot.
That hot Corinne was Carl. Lusting after, as I said in the synopsis, I will say it again.
Ha ha. Oh, yes. Tamara gets the hot Carl portion, but now we're at the Christmas party of the London office, and it's surprise at Gross Besties, a.k.a. Mark's, who lusts after Juliet's gallery. Wow.
It just makes him even creepier, the fact that he stalks his best friend and his wife with the video camera, makes secret videotapes of her, and then works at this said gallery with all the interesting half-naked people in strategically placed Santa hats.
Well, I'm like, is this his gallery? Is that his art on the walls?
Oh, is it?
I don't know.
No, I don't have questions. Think so.
I have so many questions. And I'm just hoping that Tamara will offer the clarity, since she's seen this movie so many times.
I'm over here asking you, I'm all, is it? We're looking at each other, is it? Is it? Is it? Is it? Is it? Is it? Is it?
I think that there's a chance that the gallery might be his because of the, like, weird studio space that he lives in, which is like a large warehousey type of space for some reason.
I'm going to venture a guess that it's not his art, though.
Yeah, no, not his art.
Okay, yeah.
He's just waiting to premiere the Juliet exhibit.
Ugh, that's not creepy at all. Is he going to cover her naughty bits with Santa hats, too?
Yes, yes, yes. Mm. It'll be called Reflections of Juliet. That's what it'll be called. Because a lot of them will be taken through the bedroom window, like with off of the reflection of the mirror or reflection of the windows. Yeah, it's going to be good.
Or you could just tell me, that's just ridiculous, Tam. It's not even going to be Christmas when he actually like puts out his exhibit. It's going to be around New Year's, so it's going to be little party hats.
Oh!
And party horns that are strategically placed over her tatas and no-no bits.
Or little sparkler sparkles. Yes.
Yeah. That sounds painful.
Photoshop.
Oh, yes, yes,
as
yes,
I'm
yes,
sure
yes,
the, like, the strange Santa hats that were over, like, the nipples were as well. Yeah. Mm. Nothing says Christmas party, as we spoke of, like a bunch of portraits of naked people with Santa hats on. Sarah is standing in front of a giant photo showing the backsides of five naked men in black and white, with them all wearing red Santa hats. She glances over at Carl, who is hanging out at the drinks table, while she stands there all by herself. Meanwhile, Saint Karen tells her husband Harry that she's going to make the rounds. He calls her a saint, because she is, and as soon as she steps away, Harry gets a tap on his shoulder, and it's Mia, dressed in a short red dress, and is she wearing a Santa hat, as one might at a Christmas party?
No, no. She is absolutely not, Corinne.
She's wearing fucking devil horns. And I am like, you are such a tryhard. What the fuck? Devil horns? Really? Is this Halloween? No, this is not Halloween. Why do you have, like, little devil horns on? Because she's sexy. That's why she's sexy, Mia, and she's bad.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh.
Again, Mia, better help. I have the number, and I can totally share it with you.
We need to do an intervention for Mia and talk with her about, you know, more constructive ways to use her sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mia asks Harry if he's up for a dance, and he says, oh, sure, as long as your boyfriend doesn't mind. He gestures over to Mark, who is awkwardly dancing with a very enthusiastically dancing woman. She is dancing like an air dancer.
The ones outside of the car dealerships.
Yes.
Got it. I loved your impression of that, too.
Arms flapping everywhere.
Ooh, she's feeling the music, folks.
Yes. They obviously did not have the DJ from Juliet and Peter's wedding.
Thank God.
Yes. Mia grimaces. Not my boyfriend. Harry follows Mia out onto the dance floor, and they slow dance together because there's nothing I would love to do more with my boss man than slow dance with him.
Mm-mm.
No.
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 No, thank you.
Not at all. I love my boss man. I made him a bowl cozy for the microwave. I sewed a little, like, when I was quilting it, I sewed a little heart in the bottom of it. My mom asked me if that was appropriate or not. And I said, don't worry about it. Things are good between us. Not a big deal. That's totally fine. We enjoy each other's company, generally speaking. Would we slow dance together? Absolutely not.
Hearts on bowl cozies, okay. Slow yes. dancing, not okay.
Just sewn in a little thread heart. Not like big hearts all over it kind of thing. Yeah.
I was picturing like Lisa Frank glittery hearts all on the bottom of it.
No.
Like a smattering of heart confetti.
Very subtle unless you like take time to really look and find it. Yeah.
No. You know what? You're sending mixed signals to him. I'm sure he saw that bowl cozy. He was like, oh, this means she wants to slow dance.
The secret slow dance. We've been working together for almost 10 years. And now we have finally unearthed our secret slow dance.
No. This is going to be a 3-hour episode, isn't it? We haven't even gotten through the first bit.
You know, I only have 6 sentences and it's only taking like 20 minutes. It's fine. So, while they're slow dancing together, Karen notices them across the room. And you can just tell that she is calculating all of this in her head. And she is like, oof. Okay, I'm just gonna like see what's going on here, take a step back. But can you imagine how she must feel? Like, okay, is Harry asking Karen to dance? No. No, he's not.
They have a weird relationship, Harry and his wife, because they almost seem like they've been together so long that there's like no sex going on between them. It's very safe. It's very comfortable. It's very like they probably be together forever. And Mia's hot little devil ass just popped up and was like, meow. And he was like, oh, and realized, not that I'm saying he's right. Oh, fuck. This shit got stagnant and comfortable. And now something's trying to scratch his itch. And I feel just so bad for Karen.
I feel like, so bad for her too, because she's like slogging away at home, taking care of the kids, doing like the day in, day out job that never ends.
Yes. But I don't want to be devil's advocate, because I was in a similar situation with my ex that we were together for 20 years. And I, especially in the parts where they get to her gift giving, where she was like, oh, I thought you were just going to get me a blah-bitty blah-blah. And, you know, when we get to that point, like, she doesn't demand more of him. She just accepts what he gives her.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's okay. And I'm not saying that it's justified for what he does. But I'm like, girl, you need to put your foot down. And if you happen to put your foot down on his ball sack, if that's what has to happen, so be it.
Well, and I also think, like, if I were Harry and I felt my loins starting to kindle towards Mia, I would take a look at my relationship and I'd be like, okay, am I invested in this relationship? If yes, I'd be like flattering the whole thing with Mia. But now you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take my fucking wife on a romantic vacation, or we're going to do cooking classes together, or we're going to like fucking, you know, dance class or whatever. He's got money. They're not struggling.
That's because you're not an asshole, Corinne. He is an asshole.
Yeah.
Long story short, he should be doing all that stuff and being like, whoa, 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 what is happening? And then like, just reeling it back in for Harry too. I'm reeling it back in for everyone. Zzz, like, stay the fucking route, dude. You made your choices. You have to live with them. And they're not bad. Your wife is lovely. She's capable. She's smart. She's funny. She's a prime minister's fucking sister, for God's sakes. So,
and she could tap Liam Neeson, grieving widower, if she really wanted to, but she doesn't.
We do not need any more love storylines, Corinne. Do not try to layer some extra things in there. We got too much. Speaking of which, we are now in the section called hashtag
I'm not quite done.
Oh my God, are you serious? Are you serious?
So, to wrap it all up, Harry says to Mia, "You're looking very pretty tonight." And she whispers sultrily in his ear, "It's for you. It's all for you, sir." Okay,
can
now
we just insert all that asshole stuff we said, like, after you finish that? "It's for you, all for you, sir," because fuck that guy. Anyways, now we're in the section called hashtag Sarah. Time passes and Harry is still on the fucking dance floor with Mia. And Karen definitely notices. She is stealing glances from behind her glass while she's talking to his coworkers like the saint that she is.
And being ignored by her fucking husband.
Yes. "You're a saint. Please get away from me so I can go flirt with my secretary."
Uh-huh. In front of the entire office.
Uh-huh.
Ew.
And dance inappropriately.
Yeah.
With the devil. Ha ha, literally. And while this is infuriating, we get to witness an unexpected moment of sweetness when Carl asks Sarah to dance. They move on to the dance floor. Nora Jones' "Turn Me On" comes on. They slow dance with each other and it is so sweet. They nuzzle, they caress. They are feeling all the feels that they haven't let themselves feel in the past 2 years they've been working together. Corinne will be glad to know that Carl must have finally made his move. Next thing we know, he is driving Sarah home. He walks her to the door and is about to leave, but ends up going in for a kiss. It's sweet and long, and Sarah is thrilled. She asks him to wait in the doorway. She just has to go in for a moment and then turns the corner and does a little fucking happy dance just out of sight. Then she returns saying, "Come upstairs in just give me 10 seconds, okay?" She dashes upstairs to her loft bedroom, quickly tucking away stray clothes and stuffed animals, and he eventually comes up and they passionately make out. He takes off his shirt and helps Sarah off with her dress. They're about to, "Let's get it on." Ah, yeah, "Let's get it on." Diddle-oo-dee-dee-doo-doot, diddle-oo-dee-dee-doo-doot, rings out in her apartment. Her fucking phone is ringing, and she interrupts sweet, potentially sexy times with Carl to answer it. "No, Sarah, put the phone down.
Put the phone down.
Put the phone down, Sarah.
Put it down."
We hear her side of the conversation, which involves her telling the person on the other end of the line that, "Oh, it's too late to get the Pope, even though he'd be very good at exorcisms, as would Bon Jovi." She manages to get off the phone and apologizes to Carl, explaining that that was her brother. He's not well, and he calls her frequently. Carl probably fucking knows that already, but is sympathetic. And when they start to make out again, "One-way ticket to Pound Town, let's go choo-choo!" Except, her phone rings out once again.
Don't answer it.
She pulls away. I know, Corinne, she's not listening to you. She's not listening to you. She's looking at her phone.
She's looking at Carl and his beautiful abs.
I know. Jesus Christ. Sarah, you... Oh, I question you too. But she cannot ignore the persistent ring of her cell phone, and she has successfully derailed her one-way ticket to Pound Town. We see her talking away to her brother while Carl sadly gets dressed, and he must have had a hard time getting his pants on because he left with some very heavy blue balls.
I was like, the first time she answered the phone, like, I could kind of get it. But, like, after that, just like, you turn that fucker off. He is in a facility. He is being taken care of. You can talk with him after your one-way ticket to Pound Town, because it's been a long time and Carl is there and he is hot and he is sweet and all of it's ready, lined up for...
Can we see codependent? She puts the co in codependent.
What? She puts the codependent in codependent. Yes.
I know. That's like trying to say, see... Oh, C-O-D, C-O-D-E-P. I don't know how they're spelled codependent, so I stopped. I was like, is there an A or an E in there? I'm not sure. Yeah, but like, seriously, because she answers the phone the first time. She knows it's not an emergency. He just wants the Pope or Bon Jovi to come exercise whatever the heck he thinks is going on. Yeah. It's not urgent. you don't answer the phone. God, that's just a vicious cycle that I really feel for her. And hopefully after this movie ends, she gets out of that cycle and finds love.
I am really hoping that she gets some boundaries in her life around that. And it's hard having, you know, my uncle who is most likely dead.
Oh,
Well, because he disappeared. So, you know, he's
just like my brother.
So he has like a missing, you know, thing poster. But, you know, he has serious mental health issues, and he would call my parents' house, you know, all different hours and different things like that. And, you know, and it was like, okay, you can have a relationship with him, but you need to have boundaries around that. And so it's like, yeah, answer that first call. Make sure that everything is okay. Oh, yeah, no. He's still where he needs to be, and he's still delusional. That's fine. Okay, now we're not going to answer the next call. Yes.
And we're done here.
Yes, done here until tomorrow, or at least until the one-way ticket to Pound Town goes home. Like...
Are you talking about your parents or Sarah?
No. Now I'm not talking about my parents. Now I'm talking about Carl, who we love. But yeah, okay, got it. Like to have a life, you need to have boundaries around loved ones who have mental illness issues. And it's hard.
Oh, honey, I know nothing about that. I'm giving you the crazy eyes. I'm giving you the super serious crazy eyes as I say that. Yeah. Don't know nothing about that.
Well, Tamara, you see what happens is... No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, dear God. I have like a good chunk of my phone book that I'm like, don't answer after this time. Don't answer if it's this thing. Don't answer this. Don't answer that.
And because of that, you're able to have a life. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, Pound Town, you were such a good little trip. Another couple who definitely didn't have a one-way ticket to Pound Town was Harry and his very benevolent wife, Karen. Harry was at least wise enough not to take Mia to Pound Town in the gallery bathroom. However, when Harry and Karen get home and are getting ready for bed, Harry is distant, and Karen brings up Mia. She looked very pretty tonight. Harry feigns ignorance. Oh, really? I didn't notice. Uh-huh. Yeah, sure, Harry. Sure you didn't notice. Karen calls him on his bullshit as she takes off her earrings. Yes, you did. Be careful of her, she warns. Harry dismisses her concerns, but Karen knows that something is a-brewin'. And is at this point where I say the one excusable lame fat comment happens because she said like that she felt like fat or something that night. And she has a very average to slenderer body, and regardless... It doesn't matter, but I bet she would not have felt that way if Harry had been paying her the attention that she deserved at the fucking Christmas party that she was nice enough to go to with him.
Or perhaps the many years prior to that, because it seems to have like built up to this moment. Mm-hmm. So I think he's been probably neglecting her for quite some time.
Yes. But I'll tell you, if I had a hot ticket like her in my life, I'd be like, yeah. Because she's awesome. Are you kidding me? She's cool.
And she's played by...
Emma Thompson.
Emma Thompson. Come on.
Yes.
Fucking Emma Thompson.
Who is gold. Gold, I tell you. The next day, Harry officially crosses the line when he lets Mia know he's got to leave the office to do some Christmas shopping. She excitedly responds, ooh... Are you going to get me something? And Harry initially looks taken aback by this response, however. In the time that it takes him to get to the shopping plaza and wait for his wife outside it, he apparently has processed this and gives Mia a motherfucking call. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, he did. On his motherfucking cell phone, asking her, so, are you going to get me something? She purrs back at him. Oh, I already told you, you have all of me. He responds, so, what would you like for Christmas? A stapler? And he's being serious, gentle listeners, but Mia chuckles flirtatiously. No, I don't want something useful for Christmas. I want something pretty. Harry says, right. Hangs up his phone and he's done with his conversation, just in time to smile and greet his wife. They go into the shops and Karen tells him to wait there for a moment while she grabs something for their parents. Once left to his own devices, Harry wanders over to the jewelry department, where he is unfortunately being helped by Mr. Bean, or rather fortunately, I don't know. He chooses a 270-pound, not the weight, but the dollar amount necklace, which is 470 pounds in today's money. It's gold, it's a heart. Its main notable quality is that it's expensive. Mr. Bean asks Harry, who is Rowan Atkinson, asks Harry if he'd like it gift wrapped. And Harry, whose first mistake was engaging in flirtation with Mia, finds his second mistake to be saying, yes, I'd like it gift wrapped. Mr. Bean boxes it, then puts it in a plastic bag, dumps tiny dried rosebuds into the bag. I initially thought they were saltwater taffies.
It's a delicious gift that keeps on giving.
I know. I was like, that's interesting that he's just starting with some saltwater taffies in there. Huh. Maybe that's more romantic in England. I don't know. And then sprinkles lavender, adds some cinnamon sticks. I don't know. Maybe he even puts some tears of angels in it. There's so much random crap in that plastic bag. And eventually Harry ditches the overpriced necklace because Karen has located him and she assures him, you don't need to get me jewelry. This is what Tamara was referring to. I know you're going to get me a scarf like you do every year. And they say romance is dead.
Hashtag back to Sarah. Sarah's taken the day off of work to visit her brother in his mental facility. The visit is awkward and he tries to hit her, but she quickly de-escalates things. She obviously has lots of experience with this and a great love for her brother. The following week, she ends up working late and Carl approaches her. He's about to say something to her, but ends up chickening out and just wishing her a Merry Christmas before he leaves. After he's gone, Sarah fights back tears and, in an effort to try to, I don't know, fill that void in her heart, she calls her brother, just wanting to hear a familiar voice and have some companionship, regardless of how unconventional it is. So instead of a steamy Christmas with Carl, Sarah spends it with her brother in his mental facility. Fa la la la, fa la la la, fa la la la, fa la la la.
And she loves her brother and spends time with him, which I'm like super into, but she should also be able to go to on the one-way ticket to Pound Town with Carl too. I'm just saying, best of both worlds.
We have established that, and it's also doing her brother a disservice by allowing her to be available to him at every single time.
Yeah.
Because if she continues doing that, he's just going to get more and more upset if he can't get a hold of her. If he's like, she always answers my calls. She always answers my calls, and then probably get him like more worked up over, you know, something. So that's just, I have no feelings about that section at all. I'm not twitching or my eye is not constantly quivering. It's fine. It's fine.
Good, good. I'm glad. You seemed like super chill. I appreciate that about you. Yeah. Oh, well, you'll be relieved to know that it's 1 week to Christmas/Christmas Eve. Judy and John.
We're done with the Sarah storyline, right? We're done with Carl and Sarah are like pretty much done.
Yeah, no, like I actually think that we've hit the end of the sad, almost one-way ticket to Pound Town that never happened.
Right.
We are done.
That's the conclusion to the Sarah and Carl storyline.
Is that her love actually is with her brother, not with Carl. Yes.
Right. The conclusion of that story was fucking depressing. And Ken, get back to Corinne.
Judy and John are back on set. John is standing naked against a wall while Judy is naked as well and on her knees moving her head back and forth in front of him as if she's giving him a blowjob. John nervously asks Judy, no obligation or anything, but I was wondering if you'd like to go out for a drink with me. John awkwardly waves his hands around and Judy looks up at him and says with a smile, I'd love to. John is relieved. Oh, thank goodness. You know, it usually takes me months before I ask someone out. And they happily fall back into their fake sex simulation with each other. Later, fully dressed after their work and after their drink, John drops Judy off at her place. She says, I'd invite you in, but my parents are here. John assures her that it's okay. He slowly, I can't emphasize this enough, super slowly moves his head forward to try and kiss Judy before she goes inside, but he quickly moves back. However, Judy is a woman who knows what she wants, and she moves forward much more swiftly to kiss him. They share a sweet kiss on the steps to her house, and then she pulls away, looking at him with heart eyes and saying softly, "All I want for Christmas is you." John smiles back at her with heart eyes, and she heads inside. As soon as the door closes behind her, John whoops, triumphantly jumping down several steps onto the sidewalk. John and Judy are winning at love.
Go figure. Being almost completely naked and simulating sex and with each other, I guess, just helps open up. Like, you just really start feeling close to people and can just conversate more easily with them.
You know, I've been doing this whole dating thing all wrong, Tam. I need to just start, like, being naked and simulating sex with people. Not actually having sex with people, just simulating sex with people.
Or maybe you could just start slower, like maybe just be butt booty naked at the coffee shop waiting for them when you go to meet them for the first time.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Then there's no confusion, because you just be like, I just want you to be comfortable, you know? I think this helps open up the lines of communication. If you simulate sex, maybe he might think there's something else going on.
Right. But this way, he'll just be like, of course I'm comfortable. I now have so many topics of conversation, like one of your boobs looks like an innie, the other one looks like an outie. How's that working for you? You know, and then we can talk.
I'm really worried about you dumping hot cocoa on your breastises. I'm kind of worried about them.
But don't worry, I've got a napkin to dry them off if that happens. Yes.
A big chunk of scone just dropped in your cooch. Do you need help with that, or are you gonna get that yourself? Or
oh, so helpful, so helpful.
If he doesn't get it, just tell him to watch Love Actually. It'll totally make sense. And now we're back to hashtag creepy sand guy. Colin gets a plane ticket to a fantastic place called Wisconsin. His friend tries to discourage him from going, but Colin insists that in the States, he's Prince William without the weird family. Besides that, he already subleased his apartment, so he has no place to go. Anywho, he gets a ride to the airport. He doesn't have luggage beyond the backpack that he has. And is it filled with clothes? No, it's filled with condoms, obviously, because he's going to Wisconsin, duh. He announces to his friend, this is great, I've got a giant dick and I'm ready to claim my destiny.
He is probably one of those guys that, like, he uses the Magnum condoms, but he does not have a Magnum-sized dick, and so it's just kind of, like, loose, flapping around on him.
Like a stretched-out sock that keeps falling down your ankle.
Yeah.
I never got, like, I don't think I've used condoms enough in my life to actually know, but I always felt like the ribbed for her pleasure was just a bunch of bullshit.
I found it uncomfortable and chafy personally, so yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's good to know. Yeah. Okay, I don't think I'm going to need that information ever, but thanks. Nix the loose gym sock fit and no ribbed for her pleasure. Got it. Check. And when Colin arrives in Milwaukee, it's nighttime in Milwaukee. And he tells the nearest cab to take him to a bar, any bar that'll serve him with the typical American experience. He is dropped at a pretty nondescript watering hole, walks through the front door, flings his backpack off, and saunters up to the bar asking for a Budweiser. It's the king of beers, after all. At the bar. A gorgeous woman perks up at the sound of his voice. She asks him if he's British, and he says, "Well, yes, I am." Then she is joined by two other gorgeous underwear model-looking women. They love his accent so much. He's so cute. Oh, can you say bottle again? Bottle. Hot. This whole scene is like a fugue state, particularly when the trio invites him back to their apartment. And sadly, they inform him that they're so poor that they all have to share the same bed and sleep naked because they can't afford pajamas. Yeah.
How does this get into the movie? Like,
I don't know. And they're like, oh, and then there's Carla. She's the hot one. And I'm like, so you four women stay in the same apartment without clothes or couches and share a bed, is what you're saying, in Milwaukee.
And you're all hot for his jock. Like, that doesn't... Okay, all of the rest of Love Actually, I'm like, I can see that, see these things actually happening. This? No. Yeah. Not at all.
No.
This is like some kind of weird masturbatory fantasy of someone who has had been rejected too many times or something. I don't know.
Oh, see, Corinne, that's because you don't know American women. Like, we drop the panties for a British accent.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Right. Sure.
Let me school you how women on this side of Milwaukee act. There's a certain thing that drives us crazy, and it's British accents. It's like a siren song. You can't get away from it. Somebody just has to say butthole and like nips are hard.
I can just imagine Laverne and Shirley just like losing their shit over a British accent.
They have. That was like in one of their episodes, I think third season.
Brewing for the British. Because they worked at a brewery. You get it? Yeah.
Meanwhile, Sam and Daniel, I just don't, and just in case you don't remember, Daniel's played by Liam Neeson, are at home flopped on the couch together, their feet hanging off opposite arms of the couch, while the tops of their heads touch companionably in the middle. Daniel asks Sam, "Has she noticed you yet?" Sam's been practicing for weeks on the drums and getting better. The little chalkboard on the outside of his bedroom door says different messages like, "Rhythm is my life." Sam responds to Daniel, "No, she hasn't noticed me yet. But the thing about romance is the guy doesn't get the girl till the very last moment. You know, I feel bad. I haven't asked you how your love life is going." Daniel stares up at the ceiling. "Yeah, I'm done with love for now. Unless Claudia Schiffer calls, in which case I want you out of the house right away, you wee motherless mongrel." And only Liam Neeson could serve up those fucked up lines in a sweet way. Regardless, Sam flicks his eyes up towards Daniel's head. "What?" Daniel affirms. "We'll want to have sex in every room, including yours." Hello? A few days later, though, Sam's mood seems to have changed. Daniel can't get him out of his room, even for the chicken kebabs. Sam stormily plays his drum, shouting at Daniel, "Look at the sign on the door!" His chalkboard sign has changed from hopeful music-inspired messages to an angry scrawl which reads, "I said, I'm not hungry." The scrawl actually says, "I said I'm not hungry," which was pretty impressive. Because I guess he knew his stepdad enough to know that he was going to persist to get him downstairs for the chicken kebabs.
Yeah, for some reason, he wants his child to eat. Huh, random.
Oh, God. Jeez, so pushy. Trying to feed him and all, probably want him in bed at a decent hour.
Ugh. Spoiler alert, this next section is entitled "Karen Shakes Her Fist at the Sky, Saying, Curse Your Sudden But Inevitable Betrayal."
But for what? Whatever could she be saying that for, Corinne? Karen is married to Harry? Harry the Saint? Oh, no, wait. Karen's the Saint. Harry's...
Yes.
Okay. I think I know where this is going.
Harry's been eye-fucking someone.
Mm-hmm.
So, time has passed. Karen greets Harry at the door, asking why he's hours late, but he plays it off, telling her not to worry about it. He hangs up his jacket and moves into the living room, prepared to see his kids practice their parts in the Christmas nativity scene. Karen notices something in Harry's jacket pocket. She quickly takes a look. It's a 3x3 box that's pretty flat. She opens it and sees a heart necklace. She quickly tucks it back into his pocket and joins the family. A few days later, Karen sees the 3x3 box under the tree with a note attached. This note says, "Sorry I've been such a grumper. XOXO Harry." Aw, so sweet! She's so excited. So when it's Christmas Eve and the family is opening one, only one of their Christmas presents, Karen pushes aside her kids so she can pick out which gift she wants to open. She grabs the 3x3 box that's pretty flat, and Harry happily tells her, "I know I could have gotten you a scarf, but I wanted to make sure to get you something more personal this time." Karen happily opens the box, and her smile freezes when, instead of a heart necklace, she finds a Joni Mitchell CD. Her voice rages and rages. It should rage. Her voice raises in pitch.
An appropriate slip of the tongue, Corinne.
Yes. Thank you. "This is great. Thanks, honey." Harry gazes at her fondly. "For my brilliant wife," she says to her family. "The three of you continue what you're doing. I've had too much ice cream, and I need to step out for a second." Joni Mitchell's Both Sides plays as Karen cries in the bedroom trying to get herself together, knowing exactly who the heart necklace went to. "Merry fucking Christmas, Karen." She shakes her fist at the sky and says, "Curse your sudden but inevitable betrayal." Oh, so heartbreaking. She gathers herself together and enthuses to her kids who are sitting on the couch ready to leave for their pageant. "Oh, you are so great being ready. Let's go. Come on. We're going to be late."
First of all, Karen just needs to cut off Harry's testicles and wear them around her neck in place of the necklace. Second of all, if they've been married so long, you would think that he knows that she loves Joni Mitchell. And if she loves Joni Mitchell, she most definitely has that CD.
Yeah, I know. That's what I thought, too. I was like, she probably already has that fucking CD. But, like, I think the point is that he doesn't pay attention to her. Like, she pays attention to him, but he doesn't pay attention to her.
Ugh, oh, it's so sad.
Yeah.
Oh. And now we're back to Billy Mack. You remember Billy Mack, right? The ex-heroin addict rock star that had that god-awful Christmas song?
Oh, you mean, "I feel it in my fingers. I feel it in my toes.
Feel it in my toes, yeah.
Christmas is all around me, and everywhere I go,
it's everywhere I go."
You mean that song, Tamara?
No, that's not the one I was thinking.
Okay.
Anyways, it's officially Christmas Eve, and Billy is waiting in a crowded room full of posh people who are having a posh party, a Billy Mack party, because they're waiting to see if the ex-heroin addict has the number one song this Christmas. Once it's official, he gets a call from a radio station. They tell him that in spite of Blue's Christmas song previously outselling Billy's 5-1, his song did win the top spot for holiday music. But everyone knows that his crooning wasn't better than the boy band Blue. Billy won because he promised to sing nude on Christmas Eve if his song hit the top spot. The radio announcer asks him, "So, what are you going to do now that you've won?" Billy says glibly, "Well, I could hang out like a loser with my manager and get drunk, or I could go to any number of big parties that I'll be invited to and party all night with other celebrities. Of course I'm going to be partying with the other celebrities." He gets off the phone with the radio and a person approaches him. "You got a call." She hands him the cell phone and Billy answers it. It's Elton John inviting him to his big-ass Christmas party. Billy responds, "Just send an obscenely large call over and I'll be there." And we see his manager's once happy face fall in contained sadness. Aww. Because he's happy for his client, but sad that they will not be spending Christmas Eve together.
Aww.
And now we're back to hashtag Mr. Darcy. I mean Colin Firth, I mean Jamie. Because you see Colin Firth, you think Mr. Darcy.
Yes,
anyways,
you do.
Jamie goes to his family's house for Christmas Eve. He is laden with presents, and a whole parcel of family greets him warmly. He assesses the situation, though, and says to them, I'm sorry, I gotta go." He drops off his presents and promptly hails a cab for the airport as his nephews and nieces yell after him, "I hate Uncle Jamie! I hate him!" But his family doesn't know is he's spent over a week learning Portuguese, and quite badly, but he's been trying, and now he must follow his heart. Plus, like, he wants to celebrate Christmas with his brother, and quite possibly the ex-girlfriend that fucked his brother. Nothing awkward going on there.
No, nothing awkward going on there. I was like, why are those kids saying they hate Uncle Jamie? He left the presents behind. It's not like he's like...
I know. He promised me a pony ride. I would not care if my relative left. If they left the presents, I'd be like, okay, bye, see ya.
Yeah, seriously, right? And now we enter one of the most visually referenced iconic scenes in Love Actually. Speaking of awkwardness, Gross Bestie, a.k.a. Mark, pays a surprise visit to Juliet and Peter's house. He rings the doorbell, and Juliet, who had been cuddling with Peter on the couch, springs up, saying, I'll get it, and she heads downstairs to grab the door. When she opens it, seeing Mark, her face lights up, and she warmly greets him. And Peter yells, who is it? Mark, who is holding a boombox and a bunch of signs, holds his finger to his lips in a shh, secrets motion. We haven't had secrets in a long time.
And this is the biggest secret of all.
It is. He holds up a sign that says, tell him it's carol singers. How does Juliet handle the situation? Find out after the break. And we're back. Okay, how do you think Juliet should handle the situation? And how might you handle it?
He slammed the door right in his second face. I don't know. If I were me, yeah, and not Juliet. Yeah. Peter, your friend's here.
Yep. That's what I would do too. Yeah. 100%. I was dating a guy. We were living together. And one of his friends kept on hitting on me.
Ew.
I know, right? Gross. And so he called the house for Matt, but he got me because it's house phone days, right? And I, you know, and I was like, oh, hey. And he starts hitting on me. And I'm like, and here's Matt.
Boom.
Like, I just handed over that fucking phone. I was like, oh, no, we are not messing with this bullshit.
Nope. Not even entertaining the slightest second of whatever the hell this is.
Correct. But Juliet, she yells upstairs, it's carol singers. And Peter promptly shouts back, give him a quid and tell him to bugger off. He turns on the TV, leaving Juliet downstairs to deal with the rogue caroler. Mark sets down the boombox, hitting play. Suddenly, a soloist singing Silent Night comes on, which doesn't sound like carolers at all. It just sounds like one person singing Silent Night a cappella. Mark switches to another sign. With any luck next year, card, I'll be going out with one of these girls. Card. He then shows a sign with three models, all naked from the waist up, including who we mentioned earlier in the opening, Linda fucking Evangelista.
You mean Linda Evans?
Yes, yeah. No, Linda Evangelista. And Kate Moss, and a fourth model who is scantily clad, looking sexy. Juliet laughs quietly, and Mark continues, card, but for now, let me say, card, without hope or agenda, card, just because it's Christmas, card, and at Christmas, you tell the truth, card, to me, you are perfect, card, and my wasted heart will love you, card, until you look like this, card, picture of mummy. Juliet laughs softly, silently. Card, Merry Christmas. Juliet mouths Merry Christmas back at Mark. Mark gives her the double thumbs up, grabs his boombox. By this point, two people are singing Silent Night. Still no carolers. And he walks off down the cobblestone road. Now, at this point, I just want to mention that I feel like the best version of this that is done, Love Hard has the best rendition of this that I've seen in any movie, and also of Baby It's Cold Outside as that I've seen in a movie as well. So
yes,
listen to our episode or watch the movie on Netflix or do both. It's totally worth it. Now back to Love Actually. So Mark heads down the cobblestone road. Juliet runs out into the street, grabs him by the face, and gives him a kiss on the lips. Huh? Excuse me? Yeah. Huh?
Yeah.
Strains out his jacket lapels and then runs back into the house. Mark says, under his breath, enough. Enough now. And walks off down the street. Card!
Because he has zombies to go kill.
He does have zombies to go kill, which is a much nobler quest than going after your best friend's girl who runs after you and kisses you on the lips, question mark, question mark?
I think that I have to say, at a time in my life, I fucking loved the scene. I was like, oh my God, that's so romantic. Like, he just loves you. He knows that he can't have you, but he's just like pouring out his heart without hope or agenda, because in Christmas, you tell the truth. And she just gives him a kiss. In my mind, like, it's too bad we didn't meet before I met Peter, because I am 100% with Peter. But if he wasn't in the picture, then mayhaps there could have been something. That's what it was. Corinne's rubbing the bridge of her nose and growling at me.
I Juliet doing that is like, what are you doing, Juliet? I know what fucking Mark is doing. He's nasty. Like, oh, you know, I just, in my 20s, like you said,
yeah,
I would have thought that this was like hella romantic.
1,000%.
It's like, she wears short skirts, I wear t-shirts. You know, she's cheer captains and I'm in the bleachers. Like, Mark is in the bleachers. Like, he's, you know, can you see that I'm the one that understands you?
Yes, exactly.
But seeing this, like, as a full-ass grown adult, I am like, what the ever-loving hell?
Yes, as that tends to happen, because I thought the same thing at my 20s. I'm like, oh, I want somebody to bring me signs and sing fake killers at my door. Now I'd be like, oh, no, that's just, no, I don't want that. No, no,
yeah.
No.
Yeah, yeah. So I would say that bad decisions were made all around in regards to this, because honestly, what I would have done in my 20s as well as in today was I would have been like, Peter, your friend's here. I won't mention the signs if you ditch them, but we are not doing this.
And now we're back in Billy Mac land. Billy's manager, Joe, is at home at his apartment, watching Billy Mac's Love Is All Around video while he snacks and drinks champagne alone, alone, alone. His solemn evening is interrupted by a buzz at the door. He goes downstairs to open it, and there stands Billy Mac. Joe's confused. What are you doing here? You're supposed to be at Elton John's. Billy responds, yeah, but I realized something. Joe sarcastically says, love is all around. Billy scoffs, ha, no, you wanker. I realize that Christmas is about being with people you love, and here I am in my mid-50s, and I've spent most of it with my pudgy employee. That's you. And as much as it grieves me to say it, I believe that the people I love is you.
Aww.
Joe stands there with his arms crossed. Well, this is a surprise. I didn't realize people could be turned gay, but apparently Elton John is just that powerful. Billy shakes his head. Come now. I turned down a bunch of half-dressed women to hang out with you. It's bizarre coming to the realization that you are the love of my life.
Aww.
They awkwardly bro-hug, giving each other a couple of quick slaps on the back before separating. Joe says, kind of getting a little misty-eyed, maybe? Well, it's been an honor. And I must add that Joe's apartment is decorated like a shrine to Billy Mac, with pictures of his albums, photo shoots, etc., festooning the walls. Billy gets a little glint in his eyes and says with a mischievous smile, okay, now let's get pissed and watch porn. Why do guys like watching porn together? I've never gotten that. Like, isn't porn a means to wanking, and the wanking needs to be a means to an end? And so are you all just going to be wanking in a room together, or just you know, sporting chubbies with your besties? I never got that.
Okay, but, like, I don't know how often this actually happens other than, like, in movies and books and stuff, because I've talked with guys about this and I've been like, so the circle jerks and the, you know, the porn watching blah blah blahs, and they're like, yeah, no, we don't do that. No.
I guess we don't know enough bros. Like, I see it happen, like, admittedly, in movies.
Yeah.
Like in frat houses where guys are just in a room, like, watching porn. And people are like, oh, I haven't seen this one yet. Wonder if she gets cum on her face. I think I'll sit down and take a gander.
Although I will say that in Chloe's friend group, she worked at an adult store and she had like a lot of different porns and she would play them like at parties and stuff like that. And so people would be watching them together, but it wouldn't be as a like saucy minx makeout kind of thing. It was just sort of as like background stuff.
Yes. It's never portrayed as a like, hey, I'm getting turned on. Are you turned on? Are you turned on? How about you over there? It's never portrayed like that. It is normally like background noise. But why that then, I guess? It's just like, I don't want to see something out of the corner of my eye and turn and be like, oh my God, it's a fully shaved beaver. Look at that. Oh my gosh.
I don't know. I had a hard enough time watching Bridgerton with my sister. And I was like... Oh, this is really graphic, and I'm feeling out of feelings right now, and I don't want to be sitting next to my sister at this moment in time. This is really awkward.
And I regaled everyone with my encounter of watching Bridgerton right when she's getting her due diligence on the stairs and having my brother-in-law walk in, see what was happening, and walk right back out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, don't want people around when that's happening. Not even in the background, not even as background noise. I just don't get it, is all I'm saying.
Back in Prime Minister land, David, played by the beleaguered / awkward Hugh Grant. He's going through a select batch of Christmas cards that have been culled for him to look at. So amongst the many cards with a singular signature and pre-printed message on it is a card from Natalie. In it, she apologizes for being sexually harassed by the President of the United States.
How dare she?
I know! Get her moved to a different position.
Natalie, you're too damn sexy. It's all your fault.
Seriously.
Your pipes are too great.
Ugh. This is like... so fucked up. Like, this whole thing, I'm just like, yes. Oh.
Yes. Now he's a supervillain.
Seriously. She writes, "Dear Sir, dear David, Merry Christmas, and I hope you have a very happy New Year. I'm very sorry about the thing that happened. It was a very odd moment, and I feel like a prize idiot. Particularly because, if you can't say it at Christmas, when can you, eh? I'm actually yours. With love, XXX, you're Natalie." David reads it again, and then again, blinking in disbelief, he picks up the phone. "I need a car right now!" Suddenly, the Pointer Sisters, "Jump for My Love," comes on. And David jogs down the stairs of his house out to a car waiting out front. He gets a police escort out to Harris Street, the dodgy part. And when he gets there, he realizes, one, he doesn't have her numerical address, and two, the street is a very long, with the houses very close together. Cool, cool, cool. What's a PM to do but start knocking on doors, asking if Natalie lives there? He knocks on several doors with no luck. Another door is answered by three little six-year-old girls who don't know that he's the PM and demand that he sings them a carol. Of course, David comes up with a more obscure carol. "Good King Wenceslas looked out on the Feast of Stephen." David looks over his shoulder at his bodyguard, Gavin, and the guy totally chimes in with a rich baritone voice rolling his R's. "When the snow lay round about, deep and crisp and even." The girls dance gleefully in their entryway. It's a delight, and probably, like, it's like one of my top moments in the movie, honestly. David and Gavin finally move on at some point to Mia's place. "Surprise! I didn't expect to see you here, Mia." She is happily wearing her heart necklace that Harry gave her round her neck, and she actually knows where Natalie lives, so yay! Mm-hmm.
Hurry, get out of there, David, or else she'll try to seduce you.
I know.
Or you, Gavin. I don't know. It might could be anyone.
Is Harry, like, behind her? I don't know. Like, these questions we ask. Oh, wait, no. Because it's the night of the Christmas pageant.
Right.
He is busy with child obligations. David moves on next door. Ding dong. The door is answered by a passel of family. He asks, is Natalie in? And just then, Natalie, looking gorgeous in a red sweater and very likely wearing pants, comes down the stairs announcing to her family, where the fuck is my fucking coat? She looks up, her lips perfectly glossy, to discover that she has once again cussed like a pirate in front of the PM. Her eyes widen and she says softly, hello. She introduces everyone to the Prime Minister. They are all about to head out to the school nativity play, which all local schools have participated in. And when Natalie's mom objects to Natalie being whisked away on business, David offers to take everyone to the play, and Natalie and him can talk in the car. Moments later, 99% of the family is squozing into the cop car, and Natalie and David are in his car with an 8-year-old Keith, dressed as an octopus, sitting silently between them. David thanks her for the card, and Natalie apologizes again for her behavior with the President of the United States. David says, no, it's not your fault. He's an asshole. He came on to you. You were just trying to do your job. Oh, wait, no, he doesn't say that.
Oh, I was like, really? I don't remember that part of the movie.
I wish that part of the movie had been in there, but no. No, no. She apologizes for getting sexually harassed by the President of the United States, which, like, yeah, great. Once again, and I'm not mad at Natalie for doing that. I'm mad at everyone else for putting it on Natalie and not having to sit down with her about how it's not her fault. David just looks at her. Then suddenly the car stops and Keith the octopus piles out of the car. David says, it's probably better that I don't come in. Nobody wants the Prime Minister stealing the kid's thunder. Natalie tries convincing him, oh, please come. It'll be fine. He remains firm, but assures her, I'm so glad I got to see you. Natalie tells him, just wait here a moment. And she dashes from the car.
Before we move on, is Christmas unbeknownst to me the sexy time of the year? Because Natalie signs her card. If you can't say it at Christmas, when can you say it? I am actually yours. And in previous scenes, Mark says, and you at Christmas, you tell the truth that I fucking love you. So is it like that's Christmas is a day that you can tell all your dirty, dirty secrets or confess your love and there's no repercussions or something? Is that like a British thing that I'm not aware of?
I mean, I do think that Christmas is the most romantic time of year. So, you know, for me, it's like tops in romance.
I gotcha. Okay. Don't get me anything. Just put your heart in a box and leave it under my tree.
That's a bad idea because you need your heart to live. Just FYI.
And now the pageant hijinks continue. As Natalie jogs towards the school, she passes Daniel and Sam. Daniel tries fixing Sam's hair, and Sam, who has his drumsticks in his hands, wiggles away. We also see Judy and John there, and I'm happy to report that they have their clothes on and are not simulating sex acts in front of the children. They're with his brother and their family. John's brother asks, so where'd you two meet? And they're not quite sure how to respond, saying, alternating, because how do you say that? It's not as easy as saying, oh, we met on Tinder. We met on a blind date. We met simulating sex hacks so we can get the production company could get the lighting right. We've actually seen each other naked before we ever had sex.
You should see me pantomiming a blowjob on him. I do a really great job. Yes. I give great air beige.
Yes, I can almost bring somebody to completion without even touching them. Back in the Prime Minister mobile, Natalie comes back to the car and states effusively to David, you can watch from backstage. It's my school, so I know my way around. She takes David, who is then trailed by Gavin, his baritone bodyguard, on a back way into the school when they run into David's sister, Karen. Karen, the saintly wife of fucking Harry, who practically bursts into tears upon seeing her big brother and gives him a hug. She just experienced definitive Harry heartbreak and is so happy to see a familiar, loving face. She effuses, I'm so glad you could make it. I let your secretary know about these things, but I'm never expecting much out of it. It's so good to see you. He asks her if she's okay, and she swiftly switches the topic, looking over at Natalie. Oh, well, introduce me. We haven't met before. And David, ever the David, says, well, this is Gavin, my copper, gesturing behind him, and follows it up with that. And this is my catering manager. Mm-hmm. Karen looks at Natalie and says, I hope he keeps his hands off of you. 20 years ago, you would have been just his type. Natalie smiles and cheekily says, oh, I'll be careful then. Don't try anything, sir, just because it's Christmas. And Natalie and Karen laugh while David forces some half-hearted ha-ha-ha-has. Karen rushes off with the kids while Natalie takes David to the spot she knows where he can watch. Ooh. What is he watching? Why, the fucking fever dream of a nativity scene that we've all been waiting for.
Yay!
Done. The play begins, and on the stage is a nativity scene for the ages. Kids in all kinds of papier-mâché get-ups, including whales, lobsters, and obviously Kevin the Octopus. Here's a five-year-old playing a wise man who has a full Spider-Man face painted on, and they're all singing, catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Never let it fade away. And the crowds of adoring parents and families go wild. Next up, we finally get to meet Sam's crush, Joanna Anderson, who's singing a solo with backing vocals by her mom, the great Jean Anderson, who is played by an actual famous British singer called Ruby Turner. Uh-oh. Yes. Did not know who that was. Thanks, Corinne, actually had a number one hit on the U.S. R&B charts with the song It's Gonna Be All Right. How does that sound go, Corinne?
I have no idea. I did not have the time to listen to it.
Damn it! Okay. But back to the radiant Miss Joanna, who is super cute and has a voice like an angel as she flawlessly sings Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You. That song we all know, and that song's fucking hard to sing, and she nails it.
Yes.
Sam is in the background playing the drums. The audience is stunned at Joanna's beautiful voice, as are we all. She sings, the school band plays behind her, Sam drums, a choir backs her along with a handful of teachers, and four boys doing a breakdance number close by. It is a very impressive production.
Uh-huh.
David pulls Natalie off to an area behind a curtain where several stage props are. They make eyes at each other during Joanna's song. At the end, she belts, all I want for Christmas is... I'm not even going to try to hit that high note. You and you and you. She points directly at Sam at the first you and his face lights up, but it falls as she continues. And you, pointing in various directions around the room. Sam's face sours. The song ends. The curtain draws up behind them to reveal a huge Christmas sign. And below it, David and Natalie, who are kissing center stage with confetti snow falling all around them. There is a stunned silence, and once the audience realizes who it is, they begin taking pictures of them, and Natalie says out of the side of her mouth, what do we do now? David says through his toothy smile, smile and wave, do a little bow, and walk off. And that's what they do, to uproarious applause, while Harry whistles through his fingers to congratulate that lucky bugger, David. If you watch any scenes of this movie, probably the infamous sign section, but also Joanna Anderson singing the All I Want is Christmas part is just mwah, chef's kiss. Like she just, I looked her up now. I don't know if she's singing. I just looked at her IMDb for a moment when I was doing the outline. I was like, oh, that's what she looks like now. But I didn't see if she was actually still a singer. Dang it. Bad Tamara.
Oh. The next section I call... Karen calls out Harry, Claudia Schiffer's hopefully not evil twin, and Mission Aurelia.
Wow.
I know. There's a lot going on. However, the glowing moment of triumph is over as most of the school and family has emptied out of the auditorium. Karen, who has ovaries of steel, poses a question of Harry. If you were in my position, what would you do? Your husband buys a necklace for someone, but... when Christmas comes round, you discover he's given it to someone else.
Ooh, ooh, spicy, Karen! Spicy! You're doing it at the end of the recital!
Beautiful. She continues calmly. Mm-hmm. Would you wait around to find out if it's just a necklace? If it's a necklace and sex? Or worse, if it's a necklace and love? Would you stay knowing things could get worse? Or would you cut and run? Harry looks at her, doesn't say anything reassuringly, just says, I'm such a fool. I made a giant mistake. Karen tears up. Yeah, but you've also made a fool out of me and my life. She turns and sees her kids, takes a breath, moving enthusiastically towards them, exclaiming, Darlings, darlings, you are so good. Come on, let's go.
I just have to say, I give props to Harry for not saying something like, it was for my mother. I bought my mother that necklace or something like that, trying to deny it. And at the end of that, the kids are like being dragged away by Karen. What about Dad? Isn't he coming? Oh, no, he's fine. He's coming along eventually. Like, she just leaves him in the dust like, fuck that guy.
Seriously.
She didn't say it to her kids, but her tone of voice says, fuck that guy.
But Harry also, he says he made a mistake, but what he says is not appropriately large enough for the occasion, in my opinion.
You know what it reminds me of? It very much puts me in mind of the serial killers that wreak havoc on people's lives and they make it about themselves.
Uh-huh.
I'm such a fool.
Right.
I made a mistake.
Yeah.
It's not like, I'm sorry, I hurt you.
Yes.
Like all like self-involved.
Yes.
That's what it felt like.
I agree. So what we're saying is that Harry is a serial killer. And fortunately, mm-hmm. since he's a fictitious character, we do not need to worry about being sued.
Right.
So, meanwhile, still at the school, Daniel, played by Liam Neeson, just in case you had forgotten, rushes towards Sam in the hallway. You were brilliant. Your drumming spectacular. Good job, son. Sam responds, thanks, but the plan didn't work. Daniel crouches in front of Sam so they're face to face and encourages him. Tell her. Sam questions, tell her what? Daniel enthuses, that you love her. Sam flatly responds, no way. Anyway, she leaves tonight. Daniel tries to pump him up. Even better, you've got nothing to lose. And if you do this, you won't have any regrets. I never told your mom enough. I should have told her every day. Now you have a chance to tell someone that you love them. Go get the girl. And just like in the movies, it ain't over till it's over. Sam gets a big smile on his face. Okay, let's go get the shit kicked out of us by love. That seems like an odd thing that he would say.
He does say that.
Okay.
Okay, let's go get the shit kicked out of us by love.
Good. I like the way you said it better. Your take. Excellent. Sam runs off to grab something and Daniel stands back up, accidentally knocking into Claudia Schiffer? Well, not quite. Basically, her identical twin says her name is Carol, or maybe Claudia Schiffer went into the witness protection program and we didn't realize it. Anywho, Carol recognizes Daniel as Sam's dad and they both have hard eyes for each other. Daniel bumbles an introduction and says he hopes they run into each other again and Carol says, I'll make sure of it. Ooh, Daniel and Carol, synergy, K-I-S-S-I-N-G. Sam and Carol's sons both look at each other like, oh yeah, this is happening. As Sam and Daniel walk off, Sam says to Daniel, tell her. Daniel asks, tell her what? And Sam says, you know, and makes kissy noises at him. Daniel shuts that down. Don't be such an arse, he says playfully to Sam. They head out just in time to see Joanna enter a car to go to the airport. Daniel encourages Sam, we got this. I know a shortcut to the airport. We'll meet them there. And they hustle off to his car.
Do you think arse is as bad a word as ass?
Yeah, I think it's the exact same thing as ass.
Okay.
And for the final part of my journey, and I'm just curious, I'm confused about a portion of this, and I am hoping that you will clarify with your Love Actually knowledge.
Oh, sweet baby Jesus, I haven't been able to clarify anything up to this point. I'm nervous now.
And in France, Mr. Darcy, a.k.a. Jamie, a.k.a. Colin Firth, is having a journey of his own. He goes to Aurelia's house, and the door is answered by an older man wearing an undershirt and probably pants. Jamie says in Portuguese that he'd like to ask for the man's daughter's hand in marriage. The man calls out to his daughter, and the daughter is not Aurelia. She's older than Aurelia and fat, and also very not interested in marrying Jamie. She exclaims, I don't know this man. I'm not marrying him. Jamie clarifies, Aurelia. I want to marry Aurelia. And the dad says, "She's not here. She's at work. We'll go get her." He tries to get his not Aurelia daughter to stay at home, but she'll be damned if she misses this. And as Jamie, Aurelia's dad, and not Aurelia march through the street, not Aurelia announces to passersby, okay, but she's doing this in Portuguese, but Aurelia lives in France, and he went, did he go to France or did he go to Portugal? Because everybody seems to be speaking Portuguese all of a sudden, but Aurelia was living in France. I'm confused.
Maybe she was just living in France to work there for the summer because it was the holiday season. I was always under the impression that he went to Portugal.
But it wasn't the summertime. This was Christmas time. This was
summertime. I know, huh? It all happened like within 4 or 5 weeks, Cameron. Yes. You're making a couple of extra, like,
yeah,
7 months.
Yeah, he was only there for like 2 weeks.
Yeah, I was always under the impression that he went to Portugal to go get Aurelia, but every time she left his house that she cleaned, the lady was like, "Will you take her home?"
Yes.
Which would imply that it was in France.
Yeah, and because Portugal is off of Spain,
right.
Not
France.
France, so yeah.
Theoretically, she could have gone home for Christmas to spend it with their family, but then A, why would she have a job there?
Yes.
And B, how would he know that?
Yes. Exactly. And how would he know how to find her? Because he knew where she lived in France, but he wouldn't have known where she lived in Portugal. Their language was not good enough for that to happen.
Oh, but he's got like a murder book money, so he could probably like find that shit out, I guess.
That's true.
Yeah, because the whole time, like, you raise a good point, because when you put that in the outline of, like, in France, and I was like, I always thought it was Portugal, but you raise many, many good points. And I think it might just be a hole in the plot of the movie that they just want us to gloss over and just be like, it's fine, everything's there, Portugal, France, whatever. They're right next door to each other, tomato, tomato.
I figured it out. It's Frantigal.
Yes. Yes, you know, France and Portugal, they merged not too long ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like the portal, the Hayward portal that we talked about in An Unexpected
Yes.
Christmas. Frantigal mm-hmm. is like a weird liminal space with both
right.
Portugal and France together. Bam.
Where they speak Frenchiguese. Yes.
Yes. Where they definitely speak Frenchiguese. Absolutely. Oh, I am so
Explains
glad
everything.
That we figured this
yes.
out. Okay. Hail to Frantigal. So, not Aurelia announces to passersby's, "Father is trying to sell Aurelia as a slave to this Englishman." A crowd gathers, following the initial trio down the street. They all gather in the restaurant where the dad tells the owner that Jamie is going to marry Aurelia. The restaurant owner says, "You can't do that. She's my best waitress." And then Aurelia appears on the second floor balcony, serving some food. She looks down and sees Daniel, who then awkwardly proposes to her in Portuguese, and she responds, "Yes," in Portuguese. Everybody claps, and then they share an awkward, long, dry kiss. He gets a better kiss from not Aurelia, the sister, and the dad than he does from Aurelia, sadly.
I appreciated that last line there. I was like, oh, it's a kiss so bad. We know dry kisses. We sure do.
Uh-huh.
He got better dry kisses from the sister and the dad.
Yes.
Oh, and finally we are at Sam's epic airport journey, and we wrap this shit up. Hashtag Liam Neeson, Daniel, and Sam get to the airport just in time to see the flight to New York is boarding at gate 36. They try to get into the airport, but security won't let them pass without a boarding pass. This was post 9/11. Yep, sure was. Just then, a guy who has a bunch of stuff engages with the security guy. He can't find his boarding pass, and he piles coats and luggage in the security man's arms, obscuring his general view. Daniel sees this and gives Sam the nod. Sam's eyes say, "You sure?" And Daniel gives him the extra nod. And with that, Sam dashes past security and hurdles over a person trying to tie their shoes in the metal detector. The person that was blocking the security guard's view was Mr. Bean? Rowan Atkinson? Apparently a magic Christmas elf, hell-bent on good mischief. Several security officers run after Sam, but he's wily and loses them for the most part in the crowd. He finally sees Joanna, but he's separated from her by a level and a bunch of glass. Fortunately, Billy Mack, who has said that if his Christmas single made number one, he'd perform it nude on Christmas Eve. It's on television that very moment. Billy Mack is on the screen, stripping off his top and distracting the flight attendants and security guards while Sam dashes past and finally approaches his Joanna. He calls after her, "Joanna!" She turns around and smiles. "Sam?" Sam is surprised. "You know my name?" She nods, saying, "Of course I do." He glances over his shoulder at the approaching security that finally caught up with him. "Oh, I've got to be quick." And then we cut to Sam being delivered back to Daniel by security. Daniel asks him, "How'd it go?" And Sam enthusiastically lifts his finger up in triumph. Is he saying the one? There's the one, because he has his one finger up. There's something in the storyline about one. Anyways, just then, Joanna comes up behind Sam. Daniel gives him a be cool smirk as she taps Sam on his shoulder. He turns around and Joanna gives him a kiss on the cheek. There's nothing a girl likes more than a bad boy, and runs off back to her flight. And the screen shows that we are 1 month later, and we're back at the airport, and everything is happening here. Billy Mack is back from touring and is greeted by his manager. Billy has a new woman on his arm and a spring in his step. Who knew one crappy Christmas single could revive his career? Certainly no one. Mr. Darcy, Jamie, and Aurelia are greeted enthusiastically by Juliet, Peter, and Mark. Are they now a throuple? Inquiring minds want to know, but we will never know, so we'll just speculate wildly. Aurelia jokes in her broken English, "Jamie didn't tell me your friends were so attractive. Perhaps I married the wrong Englishman?" And I say, "Too soon!" I know you don't know this, Aurelia, but he was just left by his girlfriend who slept with his brother, so maybe making those infidelity jokes is going to hit the wrong way, I'm just saying. Harry is greeted enthusiastically by his kids and stiffly by Karen, who smiles with a smile that doesn't meet her eyes, saying flatly, "It's good to have you back, but we don't believe it, do we?" No, we don't. No. What's going to happen to them? I'm thinking divorce, but maybe they'll work it out.
I don't know. And I wonder where the fuck was Harry going?
I know. I think maybe she was like, "You need to get the fuck out of my house and give me some time to cool off, or else I'm going to take off your testicles and wear them like a necklace."
Uh-huh. Wise woman. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. She needed space and time and sent him away, away, away. Claudia Schiffer's non-evil twin, Carol, her son, Daniel, and Sam are at the airport to greet Joanna. As soon as Sam sees her, he runs up to her and they both say, "Hi," to each other and smile like two big goofs, while Daniel exclaims in the background, "Oh, he should have kissed her." But Carol argues with him, "No, no, that's cool." And porn body double couple, Judy and John, run into Tony at the airport. Tony was the director for the movie they body doubled on and is the much beleaguered friend of Colin the pervy sandwich guy. Judy and John enthusiastically show their rings to Tony. They got married. They walk off, leaving Tony alone, but not for long. Colin the pervy sandwich guy returns triumphant and as douchey as ever from America, and brought with him Harriet, played by Shannon Elizabeth, and Harriet's sister Carla, who is played by Denise Richards. And Tony is gobsmacked, as we all should be with this fugue state storyline. Oh, hey, let's reward this guy who makes every woman in the world in the room. You said room and I said world.
I think both.
Same
both.
Difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the room, uncomfortable because he's sexually inappropriate with them. Yeah. Great idea. Carla enthusiastically hugs Tony, kisses him on the lips and says, "I heard you are gorgeous." And Tony is in. David, the prime minister, arrives. Cameras are a-flashing and Natalie doesn't care. She runs and leaps on David, wrapping her legs around his waist. And he says, "God, you weigh a lot." And she responds, "Shut your face," and kisses him. "It's good to see you, too."
Yeah.
And we then see a variety of people being reunited while the Beach Boys, "God Only Knows What I'd Be Without You," plays in the background. The end. My God, that was a ride.
Oh, my goodness. These episodes are so short because we cut the movie in half. So, you know.
I know. I think we need to just fill up the time with just endless banter about nothing.
Well, okay, so before we get to our dry kiss ratings, I did have a couple of theories.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of stated in the thing that Mr. Bean is a chaotic good Christmas elf because he does the whole distracting thing so that Sam can run and find the girl, Joanna. But also, he intentionally does the slowest wrapping gift ever so that Harry has a chance to not buy the fucking necklace. Like, mm-hmm. he had to go back another time to get the fucking necklace because Mr. Bean was doing him a favor by, like, throwing cinnamon sticks and saltwater taffy and angel tears into that bag.
Absolutely. I do think that Rowan Atkinson, a.k.a. Mr. Bean, is a mischievous Christmas elf in real life. So why wouldn't he play one in this movie?
Yes. Okay. Second theory. Whoever wrote this movie hates America. Exhibit number one, which is I mean, it's the truth. Smarmy president, but gross American politician. Okay. But exhibit number two, Colin and the Hotties. Like, what kind of dumbass women are in America that, like, can't figure out that Colin isn't the worst? I mean, instead, there's, like, four women living above a something or another, hanging out naked, having sexy pillow fights with each other, and sleeping all in one bed and sexing up Colin? Huh?
I mean, it's, yes, I agree with you. Not
the guy who gets banned from London? I mean, come on.
I only have one thing to say is that, yes, the smarmy president, but also look who our last president was. And it's kind
No. The smarmy president thing, I totally get. Like,
okay. Yes. Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha.
Gross American politician, totally on with that trope.
Mm-hmm. The secondary trope is, I'm wondering if, and it's a blanket statement and it's not necessarily every single movie, but we have so many stereotypes of different nationalities and countries that it might be like a stick it to ya. I hate it that it's all women, that women are just going to fall all over themselves over fucking Colin, but it is a love quote unquote story. But yeah, I think it's a stereotypical trope that maybe somebody in England has mistakenly of women in America that we're loose and we'll drop our panties for a British accent. Mayhaps. And it's just a stereotype that, like many stereotypes that we have about certain nationalities, races, and religions, just isn't true.
Well, I mean, if I were in the UK, I would certainly drop my pants for a hot accent, but I would be selective about the gentleman who came along with it. But
Well, again, Corinne, you're not an asshole. I have to keep reassuring you. You say all these parallels with you and the characters, and need I remind you again that you are not an asshole and have a good head on your shoulders. Therefore, this doesn't apply to you. These things I say do not apply to you.
Oh, and then when Denise Richards, who was brought with Colin and Shannon Elizabeth, goes and just, like, kisses this guy on the lips and is like, oh, yeah, you're so hot. And he's okay looking and that's fine. But, like, you're just going to, like, go up to a guy and, like, kiss him on the lips? Leh?
Mm. She's real, real friendly. That's what they said about her. She's real, real friendly.
Real, real friendly.
So you can't discount that she's real, real friendly, Corinne.
You know what? I didn't know they were that friendly in the South, but apparently in Texas they are. Which is not true, Texas. Don't worry, I'm not saying that about you.
They're real, real friendly in Milwaukee.
Ugh. So those were my theories.
Okay. Well, then, now that we've gotten the theories out of the way, Corinne, how many dry kisses do you give Love Actually?
I mean, I feel like giving this separate dry kisses, like one dry kiss, two dry kiss, three dry kiss, and four dry kiss. Because, yeah, one dry kiss, the fugue state romance line, totally doesn't fit with the rest of the movie. It just, if it was in some kind of like a National Lampoon movie or something like that, it would make sense. But within the context of this movie, it's in a different universe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's like a total one dry kiss action right there. One dry kiss fucking Colin Firth proposing marriage after knowing a woman for 2 weeks and not speaking the same language. And she's like, yes, no, no. What the fuck is that all about? I mean, no. They don't even, like, they don't know each other at all. I mean, no, a little bit. They know each other a little bit. But, like, seriously? They just had, like, one car kiss and then a really bad post-engagement kiss, which he was kissed better by the sister and the dad. One dry kiss for the fucking fat shaming.
Are you minusing the dry kisses? So are we like at negative three of dry kisses?
We're at negative three dry kisses right now. because this was rampant throughout the movie. Aurelia's sister was fat shamed multiple times. Natalie was fat shamed multiple times, including by the fucking prime minister himself at the end of the movie. Two dry kisses for fucking Harry. But like four dry kisses. In regards to, I felt like this movie, like I said, I did not like it at all when I thought it was supposed to be this like mega romantic movie. When I looked at it more as an examination of different types of love that people have, it made a lot more sense to me and raises it up to four dry kisses, generally speaking, minus the horrible things that I mentioned. But I really liked the body double sexy time romance line. That was great. I thought Emma Thompson's storyline was super interesting. I thought Harry's storyline sucked but rang true. And Daniel and Sam, I really liked their kind of father-son relationship, how they sort of grew together over that period of time. And And then I felt like Laura Linney's character,
Sarah,
her relationship with her brother, like that. I mean, that's like such a real thing, having that kind of thing take over your life.
Her name's Sarah.
Sarah, thank you. Yeah, her name just never stuck in my head. Thank you, Sarah. And so, yeah, and then the fucking creepy ass Mark, the best friend who never should have, that was gross bestie. Ugh, so gross. He also is like, no.
Just can't find the right words, can you?
No. I found the right words. No.
No. What about, and it's not just no. It's the no with a no. In front of it. No.
What about you, Tamara? What do you give? Love Actually and Love Actually-er.
I'm going to have to give Love Actually and Love Actually do. Four dry kisses, because I still love the fuck out of this movie. It's still one of my favorite Christmas movies. It is still hella problematic, and I don't care. It's still the storylines where you're like, what the fuck? But I have the nostalgic, gooey part in my heart that will forever love Love Actually. So I have to give it four dry kisses. I still love the almost mega happy endings that all the storylines get, even stupid Colin Firth. And the not great storylines, like I do Harry and Karen. I'm like, deep in my heart when I first saw that, I'm like, they're going to work it out. Huh. Now I'm kind of like, Karen, you could do better. But
yeah.
That's 100%. Still some mega happy ending to me. Still mega happy. Go find somebody that's going to honor you and belt out Joni Mitchell with you while you decorate your Christmas tree, making your kids papier-mâché costumes.
Yeah.
I still swoon at bits. I still like the Billy Mack and his manager and how they kind of come together at the end. And it's like the love that people share doesn't have to be like sexy love. It could be like lifelong love between two friends.
Yes.
Corinne, I'm looking at you. And so I do appreciate the way that you laid it out, how it was just an exploration of different kind of loves. And I think they cover a whole shit ton of bases.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there fat shaming? Absolutely.
Ugh.
And is there diversity?
Not really.
No. I still four dry kisses. Mwah, 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 mwah.
And with that, what movie do we have coming up next week?
Next week we are, Corinne, I'm bestowing a little bit of a Christmas gift onto you.
Ooh.
Because I Tamara Kosio on this day is choosing a Hallmark movie.
What?
A Christmas Hallmark movie.
What?
So I am choosing Christmas by Starlight. With Paul Campbell and Kimberly Sustad, two of our favorites.
There is a Santa! There is a Santa!
Chinga, 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 chinga.
Oh, I'm so excited. And then you'll appreciate the grumpiness of the movie that we do after that. So,
oh, goody.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I am so excited about the gift that you're giving me. I love it so much.
Mm-hmm.
If you have anything that you'd like to say about Love Actually or Part Deux, or Christmas by Starlight, you can reach out to us via email, onedrykiss@gmail.com, or Instagram, Twitter, I don't know about Twitter, Facebook, all at One Dry Kiss.
That's one spelled O-N-E, and as always, if you can find the time to rate and review us anywhere you listen to this podcast, we'd greatly appreciate it. But in the meantime, we appreciate you stopping by, and we bid you adieu with one dry kiss.
Yeah.
We'll see you next time.
See you next time.
I feel it in my toes.